and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Except this time, of course, there has been a bit of a delay. I finished this book around about, when was it? The 2nd of January that I finished this book, I remember, because it was at the end, oh no, the 3rd of January, because I was already over in the UK, but I've been doing some other travelling, meeting up with the parents and family members and things like that, and then on a cruise, and I've been busy doing other stuff. One of the things I've been busy with actually recently, which is some big news, well, not so much big news, but I've actually published a new story of my own on my website. It's a novella, and you can download it for free and read it. It's called Get That Rat Off My Face. And it's one that I wrote for the NaNoWriMo project last year. It's not 50,000 words though; it's only about 30,000 words. You can read it in around about. Someone said they read the whole thing in about an hour and a half, so or maybe 2 hours or something like that. So you can read it, and I think it's a fun story, an interesting story. The main theme of it is the idea of thought experiments and what happens if you wake up and you're actually in a thought experiment. And the whole book is a bit of a thought experiment about how science fiction novels are thought experiments. And so it revolves around that and like lots of other different topics and themes. It's a quick read, you know, a bit mind-bending, intrigue, mystery, that kind of thing going on there. So check it out. You can find that at lukeburge.com/fiction.html, or just find the links there on lukeburge.com. And I might also every podcast blog post that I do on sfbrp.com, there's also a link to my website there. What are the news? Oh yes, the other news that I've got is that next episode is 150, and I thought I'd do a special episode for 150. And in the last episode I mentioned that I would do a record my thoughts about different reading methods: audiobooks versus ebooks versus hardback books versus paperback books versus comics. Actually, I don't read comics, but maybe I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So if I really want your story. Two people already emailed me with them, sort of their opinions about that kind of stuff. So email me your stories and questions about different reading methods and consumption of narrative fiction in this way. So you can email me luke@juggler.net, and I do love every email that I get. I get lots of emails. I reply to every single one of them. So if you send me an email and I don't reply to it within 2 or 3 weeks, send it again, and I'll reply to it, especially if you ask me a question, something like that. But next time, next episode, I'll be replying to questions directly on the episode, as long as the questions are to do with reading techniques and things like that. So let's get on to today's novel. Already 3 minutes into the podcast, and I've got a feeling this might last a little bit longer, because today's review isn't going to be of the normal format, where I talk about the book, and I talk about the world, and then I talk about the plot, and I talk about the characters, and I talk about the science and technology, and the action, and then the themes, and the writing, and things like that. I'm going to take it in a different way, because this is a novel which, it's the second novel in a series. It's a sequel novel, and I'm always a little bit nervous about how to do that. It's always a bit strange. It's like, okay, how do I review this without giving too many spoilers, not just for this book, but for the previous book? And how many people are going to be, wanting to listen to this review if they've not already read the first book in the series? The first book in this series is, of course, A Fire Upon the Deep by Verna Vinge. He released it back in the early 90s. And it's been, like, you know, almost 20 years until he released the sequel to that. Now, there has been another follow-up book. There was Fire Upon the Deep, and then there was a book called Deepness in the Sky. And Deepness in the Sky was set in the same world with one reoccurring character. But it was a totally separate story. But, you know, going on with quite a lot of the same themes and the same ideas, but in a sort of much smaller story. Fire Upon the Deep was like this is a galaxy-spanning story. And Deepness in the Sky was pretty much revolved around one planet and one spaceship that is circling or orbiting nearby that planet. And now this book is Children of the Sky, is the follow-up book, a direct sequel to Fire Upon the Deep. And I of course, there's it's called the Deepness series, or the Deepness books, or Zones of Thought books, but people call them the Deepness series, because it's Fire Upon the Deep and then Deepness in the Sky, and now this one is Children of the Sky. So I'm thinking there's definitely going to be a sequel, and I'm thinking we've got a deep and a deepness. We've got two skies, and we've got a fire and a children. So I think the next book in the series is either going to be called Children in the Fire or Fire Upon the Children. I'm not quite sure which way around it'll be, but I think then that'll sort of complete the naming scheme for these Zones of Thought novels. So I started reading, listening to this book as an audiobook back in October, I think it was, and I started it, and I got into like the first chapter, and then sort of the storyline skipped forward about 6 or 7 years, and I thought, okay, I'm going to stop here, because what I really need to do is get up to speed again with all of the different technology and with all of the different characters and all the things that are going on here. And so I went back and I listened to, as an audiobook for the first time, Fire Upon the Deep, which is a book that I've read at least twice before, and that was, I think, the third time I'd read it, but this time as an audiobook, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Of course I enjoyed it because I've already read it twice before, and it is one of my favourite science fiction novels. And also, when people ask, hey, what's a good science fiction novel, if I'm wanting to get into it and I want to sort of show people the kind of thing that you can do with science fiction, the themes that you can talk about and the ideas and how many ideas you can pack into quite a short novel, Fire Upon the Deep is a pretty good place to start. So then I started listening to Children of the Sky again, and I listened to until about, you know, halfway through, and stuff had kind of started happening then, and then I sort of tailed off, and then I started reading some other bits and pieces of nonfiction and other things, and then I got back to it, and then I sort of faded away and things like that, because unfortunately, reading Fire Upon the Deep and then some other good novels, but, you know, reading Fire Upon the Deep had the side effect, which was that it suddenly reminded me just how good Fire Upon the Deep was, and that any attempt to match that with the same characters and with the same story, kind of story and the same themes, is a difficult task. I do think Werner Vinge did manage it with Deepness in the Sky. It's very strange to have two really, really solid books, and in some way I like Deepness in the Sky a bit better than Fire Upon the Deep. I think the characters are a bit better, and it's not such a manic story of just sort of like a chase scene through space, and there's other stuff going on there. Which I really like, even those who are the novels. And this book just really didn't match up at all. And having just read or listened to Fire Upon the Deep, it really showed how much it didn't match up. And all of the things that I was so excited for and everything, oh, it's going to be great, there's a new book, you know. It's been 20 years since I first read, well, not 20 years, maybe it's been 15 years since I first read Fire Upon the Deep. And now here's the sequel, and I can get to find out what happens next. Even though the strange thing is Fire Upon the Deep is very much a self-contained story, you don't really need a sequel. But, you know, I really enjoy spending time in the world that is set up in the Zones of Thoughts and the Tynes world. Again, I'm not going to go into that much. This is a strange review because instead of it being all before, I've actually listed around about 14 points of things which I want to bring up about these. And I'll go through why these 14 points are things that I really enjoyed about Deepness. Fire Upon the Deep. And how it's been twisted round and it's so disappointing in this book. I've sort of given a bit of this review, but if you've not read Fire Upon the Deep, this review probably won't make too much sense to you. You don't have to have read, you know, Children of the Sky to get a lot out of this review, but some of the things that I'm going to mention will probably be a little bit like, you'll be like, what? What's he talking about? What's this? Because I don't want to spend time in this novel talking about who the Tynes are and the Zones of Thought and what the Blight is and all these other big things that are crammed into A Fire Upon the Deep. I think you really need to have read it, or at least listened to my review of A Fire Upon the Deep. So if you've not either read Fire Upon the Deep or listened to my review of Fire Upon the Deep, pause now, go away and read the book, or just listen to my review. No, read the book, because it's worth reading, and then come back and then you can see what you'll like about Children of the Sky, or if you won't like about it. But this is what I'm going to say. Yes, episode 143, I made a note of it there. That's where you can find my review of Fire Upon the Deep. So, at the end, okay, spoilers, mild spoilers for, small amounts of spoilers for Fire Upon the Deep begin now, just as a bit of a warning. So, at the end of that novel, at the end of Fire Upon the Deep, the Blight is kind of defeated we're pretty sure the Blight is defeated, even though we don't know exactly for sure. It's definitely mostly defeated. But there's this fleet on the way, which is called the Blighter Fleet, and it's inbound to Tyne's world. It was quite a big subplot in that first novel, and now it's inbound at sublight speed, and it's going to take a few hundred years to get to the Tyne's world. There's two children on there, Geoffrey and Johanna, and then there's an adult woman called Ravna, and they're stranded. All of them are stranded on Tyne's world with these two crashed spaceships that are down there, and they also have hundreds of other kids which turned up with Johanna and Geoffrey in that space station, but who have been sleeping through all the events of the first novel, Upon Fire and Upon the Deep. So they wake up the kids and they set up this mini human society which mixes with the local Tynes and stuff like that. But the Blight is on the way. And this is pretty much the, like I say, it's the only thing that was left over, the big question around the Tynes world which was left over from Fire Upon the Deep. So what are you going to do about it? Now, Ravna is going to live. She's got the technology in her blood to live for a few thousand years. And so she starts this long-term plan to bring the Tynes world, Woodcarver's domain and the Tynes world, up to as high technology level as possible. And that way, when the Blighter fleet arrives, the planet and Woodcarver's domain can defend itself. And we also know that Tynes can last hundreds of years as well. They keep swapping their members in and out and things like that. So once they get more medical technology, they'll be able to survive longer as well. So this book starts pretty much with that. Woodcarver is still in charge of Woodcarver's domain. Pilgrim is still going off on adventures. Geoffrey and Amni, they're still hanging out together. Vendacious and Flenta are still sort of hanging around a bit as well. They're making mischief. And I never remember the guy's name. Scurrilous, I think his name. Not really Scurrilous, but I think that's how I referred to him in the last podcast about this series that I did. So he's still building gadgets, and now he's building airships and things like that. So this is what I got. This is the kind of thing that I read in that first chapter, which is set like 4 or 5 years after the end of... after the end of Fire Upon the Deep. And then when it skipped forward a bit, I pressed pause. And I was thinking, this book is going to be great. It's got everything that I want in it. The conflicts for the book, the goal of the book, the goal of the characters is set up. And it seemed like this was the recipe that I wanted for this book. And so let me go back, actually, and this is the, I'll go through sort of these 14 points about what I liked and didn't like about the first book in the series, starting off with this. I'm talking now about Fire Upon the Deep. I really enjoyed a lot of the characters. The list of characters that I just mentioned before, I really love them. And point number two, I love it when the Tynes are hanging out together, just one-on-one, and, pack. With Pack, you know, you get Scriber and Pilgrim right at the beginning of the novel. They're hanging out, and that's a fun team. And then when Pilgrim is hanging out with Woodcarver and they're interacting, really good fun in Fire Upon the Deep. And then Woodcarver and the Scurrilous, the inventor, making the cannons, again, really good. Lord Steel and Flenza, in fact, Lord Steel and pretty much any other character. These characters are really good fun when Tynes do stuff with Tynes. So that's number two. Point number three, I really love seeing how Tynes adapted human technology and how quickly they progressed. That's what the first book is about. It's about, you know, the humans come down and suddenly Tynes have access to some computers and they start reading about guns and they start reading about, you know, technology and communications and society and democracy and all these different things that they're going, oh, this is really good. So I really like Tynes, you know, adapting to human technology. Point number four, I really love the radio cloaks. Again, don't need to talk about them too much. You'll know what the radio cloaks are. So Tynes can only communicate within themselves, within their, you know, modular bodies when they're close together and when they're not too close to other Tynes. But the radio cloaks meant that they could communicate within themselves over wide distances and get close to other Tynes. Really, really nice idea. I thought that was one of the most interesting things in the first book, and I wanted to see it extended. You know, that was the main thing that I want to see about in any follow-up book with Tynes in it. So really looking forward to that for this book as well. Point number five, I really liked that all of the characters were proactively doing stuff in the novel. Sure, there's this big disaster, but what's happening is Ravna is going on this thing, Pham is doing this, the countermeasure is doing this. Again, I'm not going to list all the kind of things, but, you know, Woodcarver is going about this, and you see Woodcarver doing this, and you see Lord Steel doing this, and Geoffrey, he's a bit confused, but he's trying to do something else, and all the characters are doing stuff proactively. Really good fun. Point number six, I liked how they were doing stuff in Fire Upon the Deep. All the characters are doing stuff for important reasons. It wasn't just the fate of Tyne's World, or even the nations within Tyne's World to that extent, which was at stake. I'm trying to say that. There was much more going on. It wasn't individual people. It was the entire galaxy was at threat. And it was a story about the entire galaxy being at threat. It's really, really important. Point number seven that I really liked about Fire Upon the Deep. I liked the sense of urgency to all the action. Not only was there a race through space with the Out of Bounds spaceship, the Out of Bounds 2 being chased by the fleet, being chased by there's a fleet. It wasn't just one fleet chasing them. It was this massive chase going on there. But that race was also reflected on the Tyne's World with this kind of year-long or seasons-long arms race between steel and wood. Between Lord Steel and Woodcarver. That's like a really important part of it, that it was like, okay, Woodcarver's got to this point, but Steel with this is doing this point, and then Woodcarver's getting ahead, and then this is like this race going backwards and forwards, and there was always a sense of urgency to all the action. Point number eight that I liked about Fire Upon the Deep, I liked that the characters used intelligence to accomplish things instead of using brute force. So when Woodcarver had to do something, she was cleverer than other people. And when Ravna had to do something, she would be cleverer, and Fam would be cleverer. And on all these things, they would see stuff that other people were doing before me as a reader would work it out. And then they would go, oh, this is why we're doing this. And I'd be like, oh, that's really clever. And then they would do something cool with that clever intelligence. Really cool about that book. Number nine, I really enjoyed that Fire Upon the Deep had a good ending. It was abrupt, but it was logical and kind of surprising at the same time. I know some people say it was a deus ex machina, but it really wasn't. It was set up that they had to get there with this, and at the end of this, this will happen. And it was kind of like, okay, will they do it? How much destruction is going to be in the way? How much are they going to have to sacrifice to pull off the ending, which is set up at the beginning of Fire Upon the Deep? Very satisfying ending, not anything left over, no loose ends. Oh, except one loose end, which was the Blighter fleet and what the humans were going to be doing on the down there stranded. And that's what I thought we were going to get here in this last novel. The next novel here, Children of the Sky. Point number 10, Beyond the Technology. I really liked all of the stuff that was up on the spaceships and the Outer Bounds 2 and all of the things, the places that they went along the way in this big chase throughout the galaxy. Lots of different levels of technology. And it's not just one kind of technology, it's the levels of technology, how the zones of thought interact and how different alien races and the powers and the gods and all this kind of stuff, how they interact with across the zones of thought. And I like the different aliens out in the beyond and in the low beyond and in the transcend and things. And I also just like the messages that are sent around the news group messages that are sent around the galaxy. Lots of really fun stuff there as well. Point number 11, my last point that I really liked about Fire Upon the Deep, is that there is a huge amount of stuff in that novel packed into a pretty short space. It's like a 20-hour long audiobook, and it's just crammed full of ideas, crammed full of technology, crammed full of characters, crammed full of action, crammed full of everything that you want, just really packed in there. And it makes it a very fast, interesting read. There's not any time when it's dragging or anything like that, and just the pacing is well done. It's not perfect pacing by any means, but it doesn't really matter when the pacing goes off, because you're reading about some cool stuff. It goes, okay, we're going to go over here and talk about this alien culture over here. And it doesn't matter that the pacing suffers a bit, because it's cool that I'm reading about it, and it gets over quite quickly, and then we get back to the main action again. All that good stuff. So that's all the stuff that those are the 11 points that I wanted to talk about now, or that I really liked about Fire Upon the Deep. Now, what did I not like about Fire Upon the Deep? It goes a bit like this. First of all, there was one character who I thought was pretty boring, and I brought this up in my last review, Ravna Bergensdott. As a main character, she wasn't very interesting. She was less interesting than a couple of talking plant pots with wheels on them, which she spent most of the novel with. And, you know, she would always do the right thing, and when anything happened, her emotional response was always, like, really deadened. Like, she found out that all these human planets have just been destroyed, and she's just like, oh, and then kind of just moves on. And I'm just waiting, like, oh, I don't want someone just to go, oh, and then move on. I want them to be devastated. I want them to, like I think I said in the last review, I want them to do stupid stuff out of revenge or despair or lose hope or use that kind of devastation in some way, even positively negative. I just want them to be affected by stuff. And she seemed to be a little bit too robotic, just to always do the right thing and say always a bit ahead of the curve. And the thing, and it's point number two, that I didn't like about Fire Upon the Deep was that Ubi, which in the first novel was called Out of Bounds 2, as in this book the narrator always called it Ubi, and it always like made it O-O-B-I-I, Out of Bounds 2, the two I's, Ubi. Ubi spent most of the time just going from one place to another, and I remember one of my Goodreads incident was saying, hey, I travel a lot, and there's not always an interesting event that happens to me exactly halfway along a journey to sort of break up the tedium. Sure, I do lots of interesting stuff along the way and all these different things, but say I'm on a cruise, it's not as if, like, just halfway through my cruise, we're going to hit a massive rock as we sail past Italy. We're just sailing past Italy. We're not going to hit a massive rock and, like, tear a 50-meter hole in the side of the ship and have to evacuate the ship and then get on another ship and then continue our journey as though nothing has happened, just at the same speed. But we just need something interesting to happen along the way on this journey. Yeah. Interesting stuff does happen, but it has to like have a consequence and a plot point. And a lot of what Ubi was doing on the way, it just seemed to be, oh, we've got to have an interesting adventure now. So we'll go on a little side adventure, an interesting thing, and then we'll get back to the main storyline again. That's not so cool. Not a massive complaint, but it was just one thing that I didn't like about it. Point number three that I didn't like about Fire Upon the Deep was I can't really think of very much at all. I'm sure I must have mentioned stuff in my review, but really, it's a good book. There's not a lot of stuff. There's so much stuff in that book which appeals to me, which I really like, and very few things in the book which I actively disliked. I say actively disliked, which I found actively annoyed me, or even passively annoyed me. So, there you go. It sounds like I've just done a review of Fire Upon the Deep, which only makes sense to the people who read Fire Upon the Deep. But here, I want to now get on to Children of the Sky. And what happens in Children of the Sky? Let me put it this way. Fuck all happens in Children of the Sky. Absolutely nothing happens in Children of the Sky. Except stuff does happen, but fuck all that I care about happened in Children of the Sky. So let me go through those same points, point by point now. Again, hopefully this won't take too long. Point number one. So, lots of interesting characters. I mentioned them before, all over the place. Really loads of interesting characters. Really love them. Who was the main character and the focus of most of the action in this novel? Ravna Bergensdott. I was just like, oh, fuck. I mean, like, at the beginning, it was Johanna. I was like, oh, great, Johanna's back. Yeah, she was always cool. You know, spend time with her, no problem at all. You know, she's growing up. She'll have some interesting growing up times as well. No, we spend, like, most of the book. Oh, let me put this. Probably about 70% of the book following Ravna's Bergensdott boring adventures in her boring head with her boring personality. And worst about that, she's still boring, but she's not even the same character. In Fire Upon the Deep, she was always a little bit too clever for her own good. Well, not for her own good. It was good that she was clever, but a little bit too clever to make it interesting. I wanted to make some mistakes now. And in this novel, she's outwitted, like, really easily. And I was thinking, wait, that can't be right. How can she just, like, there was this guy, I mean, again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but she just gets tricked near the beginning of the book. And I was just like, wait a second, didn't you just know that that was going to happen? Wasn't it, like, blatantly obvious? And it turns out, no. And I think, well, there must be another, she must be ahead of it. There must be another layer to this. Maybe she can't be that stupid. And it turns out, no, suddenly she's, like, inexplicably incompetent at all the stuff like that. And then I was thinking, you remember all that characters that I listed that I liked? We do get some time with Jeffrey and Amdi, but nowhere near enough a time with just the two of them, because I really liked their interaction together and the way they would talk and complete each other's sentences and the way that they would kind of interact together as a unit with other times and with other people. That was always good. Don't get very much about like that. Pilgrim, one of my favourite characters from that first novel. Maybe half a chapter with Pilgrim and very, 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 very minor character in this novel. Woodcarver. She has this new pack member, so she's totally changed. And even then, we don't really spend much time with her. And when we do spend time with her, she's not a very sympathetic character anymore. She's not interesting. I don't remember anything cool happening with any of the other cool characters, which I remember for the first one. You know, like in the first novel, Scurrilous, he sets off the gun too close to his face and he deafens himself. And it's like, you know, sure, he's a slapstick character and Scriber's doing this and Flenser, you know, he's doing all that kind of fun stuff and Lord Steel is doing... Here, we don't get any interesting characters doing anything interesting at all. We don't get any of the, like, the interesting internal conflicts of Flenser, or maybe we get like half a chapter with these characters, but really nothing at all. So, not the characters that I wanted to spend time with, and characters who I didn't want to spend time with. Great. Thanks a lot, Verna Vinge. Point number two. I wanted scenes where the Tynes hang out together and do stuff together. I just really love Vinge's descriptions of how Tynes, like, physically accomplish everyday tasks. However, in this novel, there are virtually no scenes at all with Tynes hanging out with other Tynes where there's no humans involved. Every single scene that there's a Tyne, that it's a Tyne interacting with a human. And it's, again, it's the one thing that I love so much about spending time with the Tynes, is that I like spending time with Tynes. Humans are boring. Everyone knows that in Fire Upon the Deep, the human characters were the least interesting characters. Certainly Ravna, at least, yeah, Johanna was, you know, growing up and Jeffrey had the interesting thing going on, you know, all these different things, but so utterly disappointing that... if anyone has read this book and they can point remind me of a scene where it's just Tynes hanging out with Tynes, please remind me, because I can't remember a single scene in the entire of this. And every time a Tyne wants to do something which is a little bit too difficult for them, often a human just turns up and helps them out with it. Boring. Okay, point number three. The book begins with the Blighter threat and how the Tynes have to build up their technology, okay? You know, there is a little bit of technological progress in this novel. And again, I think this is one of the biggest, again, this is another one of the biggest points that I found disappointing about that. There is technological progress, but not what I expected, nor what seems to be laid out in the start of the book. Remember that I said we start off and it's like 4 years after the end of Fire Upon the Deep, and then it skips forward another 6 years, so now we're 10 years, or we're 12, I can't remember, you know, a certain number of around about a decade after the end of Fire Upon the Deep. And I thought, well, Ravna's going to live 1,000 years, the kids are going to live this long, you know, the Tynes can live long, you know, in sort of kind of pseudo-long lifestyles. We're going to see society progress. We're going to skip forward another 10 years or 5 years every single chapter. Every chapter, we're going to get a little bit more. So this chapter, they're going to be at, you know, Iron Age. Then we're going to go Renaissance. Then we're going to start getting steam power. Then we're going to start getting electricity. Then we're going to start getting atomic stuff. And we're going to build and build and build and build and build until I really hope that at the end of this novel, we're going to get the Tynes in space and the Blighter fleet turns up and the Blighter fleet turns up and they're going to be overmatched by it because the Tynes are so intelligent. They've got the brains, they've got everything, they've got all the technology, they've got access to the, you know, the anti-grav things. Anti-grav can only be built in the, you know, in the top of space, but they'll come up with their own inventions. We'll do all this kind of stuff. Verna Vinge, I know, can write this kind of stuff. In Deepness in the Sky, it follows that kind of path. There's these spider aliens which have to accelerate their accelerate their technology before winter comes around, so they don't have to hibernate. I mean, that's one of the parts of that book. And there's these other things, again, I don't want to spoil that book if you've not read it, but it's a really good formula. Vinge does it really well. I know he can do it really well. Same kind of thing happens in another book that I reviewed called The Crucible of Time by John Brunner. Their planet, their star, is heading for this interstellar cloud, and that they know, I mean, this alien race, or like a non-human natives of this planet, they know that to survive this, they're going to have to get out into space and spread to other stars. So the entire book is about a whole civilization's journey to get into space, and it starts off again somewhere around, you know, kind of like Renaissance, kind of enlightenment kind of time, but it's put back, and every new chapter is another 100 years or another decade or another 1,000 years, and society, you know, civilization has set itself back, and then it progresses, and then it goes into another dark age, and they come out of a dark age, and every time technology moves a little bit further forward, and at the end, the last story is about the very first one of these inflatable alien spacemen, astronauts, goes up into space. Unfortunately, Children of the Sky skips forward to the age of, like, early electronics and airships and steam, and then stops. After that first chapter, it just stops. The entire rest of the story plays out over the course of around about 1 year on the Times World. And in that year, we see a very, very little advance in technology, but no really major new technologies come and stuff like that. Which means the vast majority of the book is at the same level of technology. The very thing which I wanted out of a Zones of Thought, which is about the levels of technology and the interaction of levels of technology. That's what they're doing flying through the zones in Fire Upon the Deep. And also down on the planet, that's what the entire story. It's about them going, oh, we've got an arms race. Okay, we need this technology. We need radios. We've got gunpowder. Oh, we've got gunpowder. And it's about the progress of technology. And this novel is not about that. And it's not only not about that, but the technology that we do get is really boring. It's not beyond a technology. It's not even really Times technology. It's just low-level, boring human technology. I wanted to see Times in space by the end of this novel, and I didn't get there. Didn't even get close. It wasn't even what the novel was about. That entire thing about the blighter fleet coming in, we have to progress technology, which was promised at the very beginning of this book, which was promised at the end of Fire Upon the Deep, which I've been waiting 15 years to read, doesn't happen. Point number four, radio cloaks. Really like the radio cloaks. Guess what? In this novel, still just one set of radio cloaks. I thought this would be the invention that would revolutionize Times World. I just mentioned it before. You put on your radio cloak, you can get close to other Times. You put on the radio cloak, you can spread yourself out. You put on the radio cloak, there's how many new inventions are going to come around just because of the radio cloaks? Now, in Fire Upon the Deep, Flenser was the first, or Flenser Mix guy, woman, guy, Tyne, was the first person, Tyne, group to try it out in Fire Upon the Deep, and it worked first time, no problem at all. And then but they only had one set, and by the end of the novel they really only had time and the technology. It was very, very difficult to build one set of radio cloaks, so they only had one, and they were never quite sure if it was going to be safe. But you know, how dangerous could it be if you pick one guy at random and one guy at random goes, oh, I'll do this, I'll volunteer to do this, might be dangerous but I'll give it a go, and it works first time, no problem. What happens since? Suddenly, we're putting the genie back in the bottle. Nobody else can safely use the radio cloaks. It kills Tynes. It makes them go brain crazy, which was always a threat. But I'm thinking, how bad of a threat could it have been when the first person, the first Tyne who tries to use the radio cloaks, does it safely and it's a perfect success the first time? But then here in the second book, suddenly it's really difficult. They don't work. And so for the entirety of this story, there is only one set of functional radio cloaks with one pack of Tynes using it. Now, I said before, they put the genie back in the bottle. This is bad. This is just bad science fiction writing. It reminds me of Red Thunder, I think, by John Varley, which I had quite a big rant about that. If you want to know what's bad about this, that book, it's about that someone invents a technology which is so obviously world-changing and would break any kind of attempt at predicting the future. It would be one of those kind of singularity moments. It's like, okay, now we have free technology, free energy, we have free knowledge, we have free information, everything is now free. It's a singularity kind of technology. And at the end of the novel, what do? They're like, ah, this is actually too powerful. Really, all I wanted away is a clever way that school kids could get to Mars. I didn't really want to have a world-changing technology. So what we'll do, we'll limit it to this one use, and then nobody else will be taught how to use the technology. Only a few people will be able to use the technology, and that's it. And it won't be available to anyone anymore, because I want the world to go back to how it was. That's what fucking happens here in Children in the Sky. Children of the Sky. They put the radio cloak genie back in the bottle. And I wanted to see Tynes in space in different ships floating around from planet to planet. And with radio cloaks, so one Tyne could be on one planet and another Tyne could... I mean, that wouldn't work because of, you know, the speed of light kind of stuff and the slowness. But I thought, hey, but once they do that, then when they get out into the beyond, when the speed of light... about out of the slow zone, when the speed of light isn't the barrier to technology and things, they can have a Tyne in one galaxy and a Tyne in another galaxy with the same... character, with the same brain. How awesome would that be? Genie back in the box. Really disappointing. Point number five, proactively doing stuff. So this is one of my biggest complaints about the novel, which I think is now my fifth biggest complaint about the novel. Interesting stuff is happening on Tyne's world in the time frame of this story. But guess what? We never see it. Ravna is working on stuff and then is blindsided by someone cleverer than her, and she discovers that other groups are doing more interesting things, and then she is told about them. And Flenser is doing cool stuff, but we don't find out about that until, you know, Ravnar, Johanna are told about it, and Vendacious and Tycoon are working elsewhere. They're working their asses off actually doing some really cool stuff, and then Ravnar drops by at one point and they explain it to her, and Pilgrim and Johanna, they're going off for their own cool adventures, and we don't read about them, except we do suddenly read about the... We skip over all of the adventures when they're going out on their own initiative and doing stuff. And then we come into their adventure at the single point where another character influences them. And then suddenly they are reacting to that instead of doing it themselves. Instead of them doing something, they're now just reacting. Scurrilous, who's the inventor guy. I've probably got his name wrong, but I'm going to call him Scurrilous. He's doing interesting stuff. We see one or two, maybe two of his inventions, and we hear reports about him doing interesting stuff. We no longer see him building cannons and testing cannons. He's just off the scenes doing other stuff. The vast majority of this book is taken up with Ravnar having stuff explained to her or journeying between locations where she sees other characters doing interesting stuff. I'm just like, what the fuck? This is exactly what I don't like about bad fiction, where we just have different characters doing stuff and then explaining to the main character what the secret is, or what the theory is, or what the thing is. Or it's like, oh, I did this, now I'm telling you about it. It's like, yeah. I mean, I just complained about this on Basilisk Station with you, by David Weber. It's just like people talking about what they're going to do. At least they were talking about what they're going to do. But imagine a book where it's not even people talking about what they're going to do and then catching up in the next chapter. It's whole chapters of someone just doing stuff. Meanwhile, interesting stuff is happening elsewhere, and then it's being explained to her. You've picked the most passive, boring character on the entire planet, in the entire galaxy, and you're telling her story. She never has a clue what's happening. She never is the one to proactively do anything. At the end, she's shown a door and told to walk through it, or maybe that's Johanna at that point. Johanna, she's the other, like, main, I would say main, she's another viewpoint character, one of the minor viewpoint characters, and at the end, she does something interesting and important, but it happens, like, off screen. But before that, she's told, walk through this door, and she walks through this door, and the other time she said, hey, go through this tunnel, and she goes through that tunnel. People are just telling her to do stuff, and she does it. Same with Ravnar. She just goes along, and this happens, and near the end of it as well, Amdi, he does something cool. Guess what? It happens off-screen, and later Ravnar hears about it secondhand. Jeffrey does some interesting things too, but we only find out about it when he bumps into Ravnar and tells her about it. Johanna does some really important stuff, but we don't see it. We only see it when Johanna turns up again and tells Ravnar what happened. And then, yeah, so that's all, like, all the way through the book, the main drama is happening off screen, and then we're just hearing about it secondhand. Point number six of the most important things which I found annoying about this book is that the important stuff doesn't happen for important reasons. Or that, you know, let me put it this way. In Fire Upon the Deep, important stuff is happening for important reasons. And in Children in the Sky, I tried to care about this stuff, but all of the action seems so trivial. It's literally bickering among children. Intrigue for the sake of intrigue. There was no threat to the galaxy. And I said before that there's this threat to the planet. The Blighter Fleet coming in doesn't cause any tension, because once I understood what the time frame was, once I got to about a third of the way through the novel, I worked out, we're not going to be skipping forward. I know that the novel wasn't going to end hundreds of years in the future, when the Blight Fleet turns up. And so I suddenly didn't have to worry about that. It's like, well, that's obviously going to be in the story after this. But then I was like, well, logically, if the Blighter Fleet could turn up early, maybe the Zones of Thought will rearrange and they'll turn it early. But then the story, if that happened, the story would have to end immediately with the destruction of the planet, because that's what they're there to do. And I thought, well, maybe they will turn up, and somehow the choir, when I thought there was a little plot, subplot going on, that the choir down in the tropics, this, you know, mindless choir, isn't actually mindless, and they will somehow combine all their thoughts and some minor technology in some way with their thought process, and the way the technology works is they're going to outthink the Blighter Fleet somehow, which... again, mild spoiler here, but if you've read A Deepness in the Sky, I thought it could be something like that, but no, we don't even get anything remotely cool, nothing at all like that. So, important stuff. And here's a sub-point, is that you talk about different novels and stories and movies. It's like, if large plot points resolve around misunderstandings, it's not a solid plot. And that's what we get here, the disaster study group. Again, I don't want to spoil it too much here, but there's this group of kids who get together and come up with some theories, come up with conspiracies. They're mistaken, and we know that they're wrong. But they just go about it anyway, and I'm like, well, why are we even listening? Why are these kids important that we know that they're wrong? Is it just because Ravna is incompetent and can't explain the way the world is like? And then there's this tycoon and his quest for revenge drives quite a lot of the plot, and it's just a misunderstanding. It's an intentional misunderstanding, but of course, who are you going to believe? Someone called Mendacious? I mean, his name isn't Mendacious, it's Vendacious, but his name is Mendacious because he's been designed to lie about stuff. And so the whole kind of plot points revolving around misunderstandings is not very much important happening. It felt like a Cory Doctorow novel. It's like, oh, and now we're going to tell a novel about the Magic Kingdom and Disney World and about a ride, a single ride in the Magic Kingdom in Disney World. I'm just like, fuck, I just don't care. I really don't care, even though, tell you what's on it, next cruise, I'm going to Orlando, so I might actually be visiting Disney World in February, and I'm actually really excited to do that. But not to read a story about it. Maybe after I visit Disney World, I'll be interested. But again, I'm just not interested. Point number seven. Oh, this, I'm 40 minutes in already. I'm going to see if I can get through these final points quickly. Sense of urgency. Talked about this before. There is a delay of the Blighter fleet. But apart from that, every deadline in the... so that deadline doesn't mean anything. But then every other deadline seems arbitrary and pretty much forced. It's like, okay, these people are going to have a business meeting and we've got to stop the business meeting. It's like, yeah, it's just a business meeting. You can just reschedule, can't you? Just reschedule the business meeting. No, everything has to come together. But this time it's like, wait, no, it doesn't really. Like, if you just turn up, maybe when you turn up, like, and the other person's not there, it doesn't really matter that they're not there. You can just wait a few days, couldn't you? It's like, oh, no, this is... And, like, meetings. Oh, I've scheduled a meeting for this time. Oh, well, why for that time? Well, it's just I'm going to schedule it for this time. And then, like, for big parts of the book, preparing for a meeting is the main drama. And I'm just like, well, fucking hell, just reschedule the meeting or just wait until this other person goes back, then have the meeting. Just say, hey, look, guys, I know there's only like 100 humans here and maybe 500 times that we're worried about. Look, we're just going to reschedule. Is that okay? No problem. It's not as if the ship is going to hit a rock or anything and we need to have the safety demonstrations before we leave the port and before the ship hits the rock or even has a chance to hit a rock. You know, like, there's more urgency when sailing a ship out of a harbour on a cruise ship than there is in this whole novel. Point number eight. Intelligence. I've mentioned this before in previous novels, the age-old story of evil versus not good, but evil versus incompetence. The only way that evil people can succeed is for good people to be incompetent. I think that's the way the quote goes, isn't it? The only way for evil men to succeed is for good people to be more incompetent than the evil people. I think that's it. The bad guys in this novel are evil, as in Bond villain evil. Now, in the first book, we had these bad guys. Great. Lord Steel. He was built to be evil. It was an experiment by Flenser to build someone more intelligent and more capable than he was, and without the reliance on, you know, empathy and all that kind of stuff, he would be able to tell these things and use them as tools to advance science and to advance Flenser's domain. Great. Flenser himself, again, more like a misunderstood genius than evil, and we never really met him at his evil stage, but he was like this mixed evil as well. Mendacious was built to be a devious spy master. That was his function. He was put together like that. He was, what they call it, brood kenning, woodcarver, put him together in that way. She wanted someone to be very mendacious, and she made someone who was very vendacious. And then this tycoon who sort of brood-kenned himself to be some kind of like Randian hero devoid of altruism and only concerned about the free market and progress and stuff like that, which is really cool. Tynes, bad guys who are Tynes, make sense because they have constructed personalities. Turns out one of the main bad guys in this novel is human. And I didn't understand why this human was so bad, but he was just bad, and he was stupid. And the only way that he could succeed was that Ravna was more stupid than the bad guy. And, it's like, if you're going to have a villain, make the villain worthy. Well, I guess in the way the villain was worthy of the hero. But the only reason why we really like, you know, Lord of the Rings is that the bad guy is going to bring around the end of the world. And James Bond, we only like James Bond when he's going up against, you know, the real bad guys. When it's up against, I have some water and I'm going to control the supply of water in Colombia. And you're just like, oh, fuck, I don't care. But when James Bond is going up against someone big and bad, you're like, oh, fuck yeah, kick ass. And I just actually remembered, as I was talking about villains, Werner Vinge calls the bad guys villains, and he has the characters in this novel refer to the bad guys. It's like, yeah, we don't want to meet the villains. Oh, I don't want to be a villain. Oh, like this. I'm using this voice. This is Omni's voice in the by the audio narration. Oh, no, I don't want you. I don't want to be a villain. It's like reading a underwear pervert comic, you know, a superhero comic is like, I am a villain, you are a villain, I am a villain. In real life, you don't call people villains. In good fiction, you don't call someone a villain and they're a villain just because they're a villain. You have to have some, like, logic behind it as well. Point number 9, the ending. This book does not have an ending. What happens is that one villain dies and then someone clears up a misunderstanding. Remember, there's villains and misunderstandings. So someone kills, villain dies, someone clears up one of the misunderstandings, and then the book ends. In the last quarter of the novel, we do see what might happen after the novel in terms of, like, long-term technological progress and to stave off the blighter fleet, but we don't reach that point. And then the main points of conflict still remain, so there are still some of the villains in place, and there are still misunderstandings in place. And there's all the conflicts, the petty political conflicts among the humans, and the misunderstandings there are still in place. And then the novel stops. And it doesn't say there'll be a follow-up novel. And in fact, there doesn't really need to be, because the conflict that there was and the misunderstandings that there was in this novel, I didn't really care about enough for me to even want to finish this novel. I had to force myself to finish listening to this novel. And that's normally the other way around. Normally, I have to, put aside the podcast to listen to the novel. No, that's what I had to do in this case. And normally, if there's podcasts, I let them build up if there's a good book and I want to finish it. Anyway. Point number 10, beyond the technology, there is nothing except for a single broken starship stuck in the slow zone. That's not really important. There's one short chapter where we read about zone shifts and things like that. Except for that one short chapter, nothing else. There aren't any other fun aliens or any encounters. In fact, there is actually one super predictable non-time, non-human intelligence revealed in the book. But if you've read Fire Upon the Deep, it's fucking obvious, exactly, like in the first chapter, maybe in the second. No, I think it's in the first chapter. It's obvious what's going on there, and when it's revealed later, it's like, oh, and this big thing. Not that impressive. Oh, and also in the first book, there were these news groups. I would have loved to have listened in. I actually enjoyed listening into the communications around the galaxies between the different aliens. You know, there's a human interest group and the disaster interest group and the blighter interest group, and they're like, you know, news groups. And of course, that was, you know, Werner Vinge was writing about the internet communication of the time, of like 91 or 92 when he wrote the novel, and it was sort of then projected onto a large scale across the galaxy. And I would have loved to have seen him do the same thing now across the Times world. Just go, okay, what is the internet now? And let's now transport that and put it into the Times world and see how Times would do social media. How would Times, even how would Times talk on a news group, if you even want to do that? But then think, how would Times go about, you know, what the internet is like now with e-commerce and social media and Wikipedia and Amazon and Google, all that kind of stuff. I wanted to have the same kind of thing, the internet of today, the top level information technology of today being projected back into this world. And he could have done it, just didn't even bother. Just all of that aspect, all of alien technology, all of beyond the technology, all of everything, just completely absent from this book. Point number 11 of the things that really spoiled this book for me is that this book is not short. The first book was short and it felt crammed full of stuff. This, that was Fire Upon the Deep, was about 20 hours. This is just under 30 hours. 30 hours of tedium. Which brings me to these pacing issues. Lots and lots of long journeys between places, which I really didn't like in the first thing. There's a lot of this book is long journeys. We're at sea. How long is it going to take us there? Fucking months. Okay, let's go on a fucking month-long sea journey. Where are we going? Oh, we're on a horse and cart. Fucking hell, a horse and cart. This is going to take weeks. Yeah, and it sounds like I'm reading it in real time or listening to it in real time. And there's this circus scene. Fucking hell. Set up a circus and it just goes on and on and on. And they do a performance here and a performance there and a performance here. And I'm just like, what happened at the end of that whole subplot with the circus? That end event, which you were building up to for hours of the audiobook, or felt like hours of the audiobook, you could have just got to straight away. Everything in between was a wasted effort. And then there's these other parts where they're like, there's these dead bodies, and they're, you know, they're looking for these dead bodies. And I'm like, look, anyone with a brain or has even read the book, if you read this far in the book, you know what we're going to find when we get to these dead bodies. But no, we have to read or listen to, like, every single boring step like a description of what every single character is doing every minute of the search up until we know what it's leading up to. There's a punchline coming and we know the punchline. Just fucking get to it. Anyway, that covers, I think, all of my points. All those stuff that I did like about Fire Upon the Deep, which was missing, or not just missing, but was the opposite. It was the things that I didn't like, the few things that I didn't like about Fire Upon the Deep were brought to the foreground and then multiplied and amplified here in Children of the Sky. Which explains most of the reasons why I really struggled to finish it. I kept putting it off, but I thought in the end I was like, no, I'm not going to listen to any other audio, no other podcasts, until I'm done with this. And like I say, normally if I'm listening to a good novel, I forget about anything else. I'm just like, oh, fuck, I don't even want to read a normal book. Even when I'm laying in bed and I could be reading a paper book or an ebook, no, I'll stick the earbuds in and listen to the audiobook. And then I was thinking, well, maybe it just wasn't what I expected. You know, there's a lot of sequels to original books in the series which depart completely from the first novel. For example, well, it's not a complete departure, but if you read Fire Upon the Deep and then you read Deepness on the Sky, it's a different book about different characters and different places, and it's not the same scale, but it's really good. And you know, a great example of this kind of thing is Ender's Game. Read Ender's Game and then read Speaker for the Dead. It's not as if, like, Speaker for the Dead is anything at all like Ender. There's, like, two characters in common and one or two themes, but really it's a whole book about different things. The first one was a book about, you know, war and genocide and xenocide, and the second book was a book about absolution and stuff, and just adult characters instead of kids, you know, large communities living in a rural setting instead of on a spaceship in a battle station, things like that. Both won Hugo Awards, both my favourite novels by Orson Scott Card, and I'd say both books are pretty good. And also a series that I've reviewed here as well with Peter Watts. He did Starfish and then Maelstrom and then Behemoth. Starfish, Maelstrom, totally different books. And Behemoth is sort of, it kind of combines the two of them. But loads of people are split on which novel is better. Loads of people say, oh no, Maelstrom is way better than Starfish. And other people, no, Starfish is way better than Maelstrom. And also the culture novels by Ian M. Banks, every one of them, sure, you get recurring themes, but all of them are different novels, different tones. Some of them are really lighthearted, some of them are, like, super dark. Some of them are written in different languages, some of them are written about the aliens, some about the spaceships, some about the humans, some about this, some about that, and they're all really different. But what's worse than just having an unexpected departure from a format or an idea or a theme or a storytelling sign or a setting or characters when we get to the second book? I don't mind unexpected as long as it's good, but this took a turn into territory which I just don't care about. Or, if it's territory that I do care about, it has to come with all the stuff that I want a good novel to come with. One example of this is the stories which this is about. It's about, like, humans establish a colony elsewhere, and then all the drama is only within the human society, and it's about, like, local petty politics. Now, there was a story, Arthur C. Clarke's Rama series, that happens, I think it's Rama 2, or Return to Rama. It's not Rendezvous Rama, it's one of the later ones. And there's a certain small group of characters who are in this starship, and it's all about the starship. The whole first half of the novel is about them going around the starship and exploring, and they go through space, and then they come back to Earth, and then they pick up more humans, and then it sets off again, and now all of the stuff that we had before about the drama and the exploration, all the stuff that I was reading an Arthur C. Clarke novel, Rama, you know, I want people to look around big spaceships. I want stuff being described to me. That's what I want from an Arthur C. Clarke novel. I want interesting technology and wonderful alien shit being described to me in intricate detail, and, you know, bringing out themes of humanness and life and transcendence and, you know, different forms of consciousness. And then, like, that second half of the book just devolves down into, ah, we've got some humans here. Some of them used to be criminals, and lots of them are going to be stupid. And that's what the drama is going to be like for the second half of the book. And that's what we got here in Children of the Sky. Lots and lots of drama just boils down to petty politics between humans. Not even between humans and Tynes, although that is a little part of it. But it's just, like, stupid misunderstandings and stupid people doing stupid things. And the only way it's succeeding is that other stupid things. And there's just no subtlety to it either. I made a note here in Avatar. There's no subtlety. The good characters are good, the bad characters are bad. And the bad characters are doing bad stuff for obviously bad reasons. They have unobtainium, and it's like, we're going to knock down this big tree to get this unobtainium. And I'm like, well, why? I mean, at least make it big. I heard someone mention once, probably on a podcast or in another review of Avatar, and they're like, why don't they make it so unobtainium is the thing which the humans need back on Earth to not only, you know, run their energy, but there's this massive other alien threat out there. And if the humans don't get enough unobtainium, all of the human race is going to be wiped out. But they need to get unobtainium from underneath the Navi's Pandora, whatever it is, the underground, under the tree. And they want this kind of thing, and they've got to get out. Now, wouldn't that make a much more dynamic, interesting story? And the humans wouldn't just be, well, these humans are fucking idiots, aren't they? Oh, why don't we just bomb it from space? It's the only way to be sure. What do you think? Anyway, it's that kind of level that we get through this book. And the rest of the novel is just passive, stupid people moving from one place to the other, having stuff explained to them, and following the instructions of other people. Sigh. Anyway, that's all I want to talk about there. Quickly, a few more things to which aren't around about these points and about how disappointing this book was. The writing is actually pretty good, except for a few points. The children are all called children, not humans. And there's nothing to distinguish between the human adult children and the human children children. Maybe it's just in the audiobook that there'll be a capital letter for children when they're like talking about the Children of the Sky, which are some of the adults who used to be children and have now grown up, and now they're still being called children. Another thing is there's some... maybe it's just an audiobook thing, but some of the names do get a little bit complicated. The Tynes, often when you get them, when one person's called blah, 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 and the other one's called blah, 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 and it's just a little bit different. But then even the human names, you get a Jeffrey and a Jenny and a Jemmy and a Johanna, and maybe it's just me, but they seem to be a little bit too confusing in that way. And also, it took me a while when they kept saying Ubi, and I was like, I can't remember what the name of the spaceship was from the first book. I'm sure it wasn't called Ubi, and it was called Out of Bounds 2, and it's been abbreviated down to Ubi in this novel, and that was my own fault, because I'm listening to it as an audiobook. But then there's these different things, like the word selection, like the word villain, and at another point it was like, oh, it brought out his geeky side, and then he was a bit geeky, and I'm thinking, this is a bit strange. It's like, and it only comes up in one pint, so it's like Werner Vinge was like writing one chapter every month and then would come back, and then one month he learnt the word what geek was, and then he suddenly starts using the word geeky. And if it was like a character who brought up the word geeky, that would be it. But we never got the word geeky in the first novel, even though Jeffrey is an obvious geek and Ravenna is a geek and all that kind of stuff. And then suddenly geeky comes up and Tynes are talking about their geeky sides. And yeah, it's just a weird, weird choice. Another thing about the writing. Oh, yeah, there's a juggling scene. Someone juggles and it's like, oh, and this person could juggle. He always was a good juggler. And then it's like this one thing, it's like, oh, and he was juggling four balls, and then someone just threw in the fifth ball, and he went from four balls into juggling five balls without even breaking a stride. Just so you know, as a professional juggler, if you don't know that's what I do, I am a professional juggler, five-ball juggling is fucking hard. You don't just happen to have that skill. You know, nobody is accidentally a five-ball juggler. And certainly, even a professional juggler, like myself, nobody accidentally throws me a fifth ball at some point and I just spontaneously go from four-ball juggling to five-ball juggling. That's a trick that only, like, the top jugglers in the world can just do whatever. And I, in my show, have a 10-minute routine built around getting to that very trick with getting an audience member to throw me a fifth ball and for me to go from four-ball juggling into five-ball juggling. It takes 10 minutes to get to that point, to juggling five balls as the build-up. Of course, there's a lot of comedy. And the main comedy is that it's actually fucking impossible and I can't do it. I've never done it. Nobody has ever. I've never juggled on stage four balls and someone throw me a fifth ball and me go into juggling five balls perfectly on the first time. Certainly not by accident. Now, this is just a minor point because I am a professional juggler. But it does get to me. It's like, okay, the one thing that he touches on in this novel where I'm actually, like, an expert at it, you know, quite a, within juggling circles, quite a, like, world-renowned expert at juggling and a professional entertainer and professional performer. And he gets that wrong. It's like, oh, well, how many other things has he got wrong? But the thing is, there's not actually enough interesting in this book for me to care about, that even if he did get it wrong. He doesn't know cool stuff. Final thing about the writing is obviousness. For example, if you suddenly spend time with a tyne, up until that point, you've never had the pleasure of spending time with that tyne as a viewpoint character. You know they're about to die, because you spend some time with the character and you build up the sympathy for that character, and then it's just obvious. In Fire Upon the Deep, when this happens, it was suspicious, but then when it happened, it was clever, because you think, well, they can't kill off this character, and we're just spending some time with them because they're doing something interesting and something clever, and they're using their brain, and even though we can see that they're being stupid, they think they're being clever, and that's interesting when someone thinks they're being clever, but they're being outsmarted, and we can see someone clever outsmarting them, and it was good, but then that person is killed. And then when he does the same trick here, it's not even an interesting, clever person doing something clever and then being outsmarted. It's just somebody being a bit stupid and then being outsmarted and being killed. And other things are just foreshadowed so clunkily that there's just no tension. For most of the set pieces, you already know the outcome. Like the circus scene, you know what's going to happen. When you get to the scene where you know where it's obviously what's going to happen, it happens. And then you think, oh, that was obvious. Like the search for the bodies. You're like, well, we know what they're going to do when we find the bodies. We know what's going to happen. We know the punchline. Johanna disappearing at the end. It's like, well, we know what's going to happen here. Then she turns up and it does it. And then there's some other things which I thought would be obvious and clever. For example, one main character was like subsumed into the choir down in the tropics. And I thought, well, surely the strength of that character's mind would spread throughout the entire choir, and then later in the novel he will help out another character via the choir. He becomes sort of godlike. He transcends. His mind spreads out and he becomes part of the choir. No. Turns out that, to me, was obvious. For me, that was obviously going to happen later on in this book. And then I was disappointed that it didn't happen, because it at least would have been really cool if that happened. And in Fire Upon the Deep, there's lots of really obvious stuff that happens. But it happens in cool ways, and it happens quickly. And it's a short book. Even the end of the book, you know what's going to happen. It explains at the beginning that this is going to happen, and then you get there. But it happens in cool ways. And in Children Upon the Sky, it like boringly drags on for ages before we see the thing that we predicted playing out perfectly the same that we predicted it. So, reading. Very good at reading, actually. One of the most enjoyable things about the novel, one of the saving graces of the novel, was, I checked, I think it's Oliver Wyman, but I couldn't find the name again. I think I made a note of that before. Oliver Wyman, the narrator, very, very good. Lots of different voices. I really loved all the Tynes' voices that he does. All of the different Tynes are immediately recognisable just by their voices. The human characters, again, sometimes a little bit whiny, but I think it's a different narrator than the Fire Upon the Deep. But otherwise, really, really good. At this point, I normally talk about the themes of the novel, but fuck that, I've been going on an hour already. In conclusion, I'm going to give this novel 2 stars, because it is bad. I really didn't enjoy it, but it's not like a really bad book. It was just disappointing in a way that was like crushingly disappointing. It was like reading Hyperion and then reading Fall of Hyperion. From such a high point, it falls so down low. But I don't want that to influence it. Like, if I was going to judge it as a standalone novel, it would probably be a 2-star novel. How disappointing would it? It would have brought it down. It would have been like a 1-star novel for me. But it really, I'm just going to give it 2 stars, because I think that is the fair thing. And I did finish it, you know. When I got to the end, I was like, well, at least I got through that. So I would say, do not read this novel. Certainly if you've not read Fire Upon the Deep. Wait, there will be another sequel. So I say, wait until the other sequel comes out, and then wait for someone to read that, and then ask them, hey, is it worth reading both of these novels together? Do we get an end point? Do we get any resolution? Does exciting stuff happen? And then they'll say, yes, and then you can read both of them together. But if they say no, don't. I did this with the Aspect Emperor series by R. Scott Bakker. The new book came out, and everyone said, oh, don't read it, it doesn't have an ending. And then when they read the second one in the story, they said, oh, you can read these two together, it forms a unit, so I did. But in this case, I'd actually say, if another novel comes out, wait for someone to read it, and if Children of the Sky is just kind of a link novel between Fire Upon the Deep and Children in the Fire, or Fire Upon the Children, or whatever the fourth novel, or third novel in this series is going to be, you could probably get away with not reading this book at all, reading the plot summary on Wikipedia, and just going along. Unless you're a fan of pointless political petty intrigues, which is all that happens, unless you're a fan of other people, non-main characters, doing the pointless political petty intrigue, and then have the boring passive character find out about that intrigue later, secondhand, or in some cases, third hand. Or if a 5-hour abridged version comes out or someone edits it down, just read that instead. So that's it. I did actually look across here on goodreads.com because I opened up these pages before to get the links to put in the show notes as well. I don't always get Amazon open, but check it out on Amazon. The average 3-star review, there's 12 5-star reviews, 10 4-star reviews, 20 3-star reviews, and then 10 and 11 2 and 1-star reviews. First review that comes up, disappointing. October 17th, 2011. Disappointing. October 18th, 2011. A good read, but not as great as Vinge has been. October 12th, 2011. You can see it's not just me who's disappointed with this. It's obviously long-term fans as well. Look across here on goodreads.com. Average 3.39. Now, normally what happens is when a second book in a series comes out like this and there's a big fan base of the original work, all the big fanboys and fangirls and the fans of the author, they're like, oh, I've got to read this. And they read it and they're like, oh, it's just the greatest book ever. Oh, it's the best book ever. And it gets like 5 stars. So for this book to be only out like 2 months, 3 months, and have a 3-star rating or a 3.39-star rating means it really isn't just me. Sorry to the 22 friends. Oh, actually, friends reviews here on goodreads.com. People who are friends with me. And obviously, you listen to this, that's only got a 3.75 average, which I think is very, very generous. To give this any more than 3 stars is very, very generous. But Ziven rated it 4 stars. Larry, 5 stars. What are you thinking? I hope there is going to be another book to resolve the issues. There was a rather surprising love scene in the end. Actually, yeah, that's another bit that I enjoyed about it. Some of the human relationships are actually pretty good. And some of the other relationships, the time relationships, are pretty good too. There is that, but I just wanted more time stuff as well. Tom, 2 stars. Matt, 4 stars. Andre, 4 stars. Sandy, 5 stars. Sandy, did you read the same book as me? I'm not sure. And Tudor, 3 stars. I think that's all of the people, all of my friends on goodreads.com. Anyway, I have gone on way longer than I was planning to. I knew it would be a long review, but I was really hoping to keep it down to under an hour. But it's an anticipated review. It's a big book. I had a lot to say about it, obviously. Probably could have said it a bit shorter. But tell you what, if I could do it in half an hour, but instead I just want to take maybe an hour to tell half the story, so maybe the entire podcast should last about 2 hours. There's no reason I should do that. I shouldn't have to edit myself down, should I? Maybe, you know, I'm a good podcaster. Nobody needs to edit me. If I want a story to last another 3 books and each book to last 3 times as long as the original book in the series, which everyone loves, you know, that's the format that people want, isn't it? Just do as long as possible. It doesn't matter how long it takes, right? Anyway, next episode will be a special episode about reading and stuff, so email me, luke@juggler.net. You can also follow me on Twitter. You can even be my friends on Facebook now, because I've got this group of friends on Facebook, which I can just put science fiction nerdy podcasty stuff, and only science fiction nerdy podcast people like yourselves can read it, so that's pretty cool too. Although most of the stuff that I put on Facebook is juggling stuff and photography stuff. I've got a blog as well, you can find it on my website. I did read another book. It's called The Little Prince. And Little Prince is a very famous book. I thought it wasn't quite science fiction-y or fantasy enough, even though it is talking about other planets and traveling between the stars. I didn't think it was quite substantial enough to do a review. But if you want me to do a review, if you want to hear a review of a book which takes around about an hour to read, if you want to hear a review of what is essentially a short story, it is an independent book, though. It is a bound single book. Normally I don't do short stories. Some novellas I'll do a review of, but only if it's like a book, as like a unit in itself, rather than just a short story. But if you want to hear a review of The Little Prince, email me, luke@juggler.net. That's it for now. Thanks for listening to this long episode of mostly ranting and complaining. Hopefully you've had fun, and I'll catch you next time.